From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Samantha Wright, filling in for Jim Godette. This is Idaho Matters. In 1912, a llama named Spook was living in New York's Central Park Zoo, far from his home in the South American highlands. And his story, along with others like him, are the basis for a new article that traces llamas through and beyond South America. Emily Wakehill, the Cecil D. Andrus Endowed Chair for the Environment and Public Lands, wrote the chapter for a new book called Traces of the Animal Past, Challenges in Animal History. We wanted to find out more about Spook the Llama and others who have been forced out of their homeland and into strange places, so we asked Emily to come back on the show. Hello, Emily. How are you?
I'm great, Samantha. Thanks for having me on today.
Let's start with Spook the Llama. Tell us his story.
Yeah, so Spook is a cantankerous old beast that lives in the Central Park Zoo, and he develops an interesting talent, which is mocking the horns honking on the streets around Central Park. And so they move him around the zoo because his honks are causing car accidents and pileups and just sort of wreaking havoc around the zoo. And it seems that he was lonely, and it also seems that he's kind of adapting to his new environment. And in 1912, it was pretty common for zoos to have exotic animals. And so he was a feature in the zoo, but his behavior got him sort of moved around. And eventually it got him kicked out of the zoo and moved upstate to live on a farm along the Hudson River. And there he learned to mimic boat or ship horns and sort of cause the same disruption in that place.
Wow. How did you first find out about Spook?
Yeah, so as a historian by training, I look back in time for traces of the past, right? For pieces of evidence that allow us to understand how people lived before us. So there was a lot written about Spook in the New York Times. And then once I knew the characters in his story, for example, the zoo director, I was able to piece together other parts of his story from specific documents. But I began looking at llamas as this really interesting prism we can use to try and understand the Andean influences that inhabit the Americas, right? So another example, just like the llama, is the potato, right? The potato is a product of Andean invention and ingenuity that has spread around the world, right? And influences economies, it influences culinary culture, and all sorts of things. But llamas are an interesting way of thinking about the concept of a diaspora, because the llamas and the diaspora allows us to reframe kind of how we categorize animals, right? There's often these binaries between wild and domesticated, or endangered and exotic, or common animals. And thinking instead about how they circulate around the world tied to human cultures allows us to look at animals as part of a relationship with humans and less sort of just a species or this sort of amorphous category. And then the diaspora becomes this orientation device that allows us to trace genealogies of exchange and production, and also to sort of see new ways of thinking about how humans relate with each other and also how humans relate with other folks. I want to say, of course, the concept of a diaspora relates to world to cultural populations around the world that have been dispersed or forcibly displaced, that have an enduring connection to their homeland from which they've been displaced, and that promote exchange across that. And so the diaspora concept isn't perfect for llamas because they have been displaced or brought around the world, and they certainly still inhabit the places they originated in the Andes, but there's no evidence of llamas writing letters to each other, right? Or having some sort of exchange across those communities. And so in the way that Jewish diasporas or the African or Armenian diasporas really do have that meaningful exchange.
Well, you mentioned, llamas have been all over the world. And we just talked about Spook. Where are some of the other places they've popped up? I mean, over time, they've been all over the place.
They have. So the first examples of llamas being taken from, well, we should go back millions of years to start, right? And camelids, which is the family that llamas belong to, and horses, both originated on the Great Plains of North America 50 million years ago, right? So they're sort of native here, but they were part of the Pleistocene overkill, or sort of the extinction of large mammals that occurred 10 to 20,000 years ago. And so they disappeared and then only inhabited the Andes of South America. And that is where they evolved into different species. And that's really what we can think of as their homeland. But when the Spanish arrived in 1532 in the Andes, they were stunned by the llama. And within the decade had brought llamas back to European cities and displayed them as exotic and strange. And there's all sorts of interesting commentary on how they tried to make sense of llamas, right? Sort of ugly or more cute than camels, and not quite a deer, and the face of a horse, but the body of a sheep, and sort of trying to make sense of their parts in that way. But another interesting thing happened when the Spanish came to the Americas, which was that llama populations and their wild ancestors went through a population bottleneck where more than 90% of them died, very much like human populations, because of the disease that was brought and the violence. But the disease in particular for the llamas led to this bottleneck in their population. And so there is a really big difference between mummified llama genetics that can be traced back at least 3,000 years in the Andes, and the llamas that inhabit Idaho today, right? They're similar species in a lot of ways, but in other ways, they're quite distinct because of that 90% loss and bottleneck in the 16th century.
Wow. We're speaking with Emily Wakehill, the Cecil D. Andrus Endowed Chair, about her research into the llama diaspora about or through and beyond South America. I think it's fascinating that you can use llamas and the history of llamas to tell us about not just llamas, but people and cultures over time.
Yeah, so one of the reasons why I think why I like to talk about and write about llamas, and I think other people are drawn to them as well, is that llamas inhabit this kind of middle space, right? They're not the largest animals, they're not the most aggressive or sort of widespread, but they are the only domesticated animal from South America, over 100 pounds, and they are also ever present, right? We see llamas all the time, so they're sort of ubiquitous. Mm-hmm. At the same time, they are exotic. They're at petting zoos and fairs. You can rent them for kids' birthday parties and take them hunting with you, right? They can even fly on a jet boat and transport, you know, elk that have been killed on a hunt. But they are also part of this landscape that we recognize as normal, right? And they've been kind of grafted on to the Rockies and the American West, even though they've been sort of displaced from their homeland in doing that. And so they are part of this domestication process that's ongoing between humans and their species. And I should back up for a second and say that llamas are one of four camelid species. Two of them are domesticated, right? Llamas and alpacas are what we would find here in the United States at these zoos and petting fairs. But the guanaco and the vicuña are the wild species that are related to both of those. And all four of those Andean or South American species are also related to camels. And they can all produce live offspring in any sort of configuration of those. And so they're close cousins and relatives. And yet the difference between a small vicuña, which is a elegant wild animal that produces the highest quality and most expensive kind of wool. It's, you know, four times the cost of cashmere for a vicuña wool sweater, for example. Wow. And the llama is a large pack animal that that has sharp ears and a sort of larger body and a tail that perks up. And these two animals are related to each other, but inhabit really different worlds and have different roles for the humans that relate to them.
Wow, that's it's amazing, and we've only just barely scratched the surface of the article. We've been speaking with Emily Wakehill, the Cecil D. Andrus Endowed Chair for the Environment and Public Lands. Her article on llamas can be found in the new book, Traces of the Animal Past, Challenges in Animal History, and we'll put a link to the article on our website, boisestatepublicradio.org. I'm Samantha Wright, filling in for Jim Agudat. You're listening to Idaho Matters.
Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts.
Experiencing the news each day can feel like a journey. With Up First from NPR, it doesn't have to be. Welcome to 15 easy minutes of breaking news, clarity on international and national affairs, all handed over not from some floating voice in the sky, from us, Layla, A, Steve, and me, Rachel. Start your day informed. Subscribe to Up First wherever you get your podcasts.